This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking about the history of the Super Bowl and the connection between race and professional football. Joining us from across the lake in Michigan is our guest, Lewis Moore. He's a professor of history at Grand Valley State University and specializes in sport, African-American, and gender history. Give us a call and tell us what you want to know about the history of the Super Bowl or want to know about influential black quarterbacks. I knew I was going to do that. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Professor Moore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. So there's a little game coming up, I heard. You know, it just seems like it's been there forever. But what is the background on the Super Bowl?
Yeah, so the Super Bowl starts in 1967, and it's really about a competition. And also, you know, there's a lot of animosity between two leagues. So in 1960, a brand new football league starts, the American Football League. We know it as the AFL. And they start kind of encroaching on the NFL's territory, signing players like a Joe Namath a few years later, and really getting into those markets. And so eventually, the two leagues, I know it's a long story short, the two leagues come together and the NFL absorbs the AFL into the league. And part of the negotiations, like, okay, now we can start playing each other. Well, also, let's have a championship game. Let's see who's actually the best league. Now, it was clear at that time, because the AFL was so young, that, you know, NFL team like the Green Bay Packers, who actually played in the first Super Bowl, were going to be superior. But over time, you know, the AFL catches up. But that's how we get the Super Bowl. It's a merger between two leagues that didn't want to compete with each other for players, which also raises players' salaries. They come together. That stops that. And all of a sudden now you have two leagues competing for a Super Bowl, and then they are now one and the same.
And there was a lot of animosity at the time before they came together, wasn't there? One was trying to outdo the other and get rid of the other one.
Yeah, well, you know, they're new. The AFL was so new. And I think because the NFL thought they were, for lack of better terms, the big dog on the porch, right? They were annoyed by that. And what happens, though, for the players, when you have finally another league to compete with, that means their salary goes up. So all of a sudden, you have to sign, if you want the star quarterback like Joe Namath, who comes out of Alabama, now you got to pay him. I think he gets like $400,000, which is unheard of at that time. But because he had options of where to go, and every player has an option of where to go, salaries just, you know, increase. And I don't think these leagues could actually financially afford that anymore. So coming together for them makes sense.
Mm-hmm. That's changed a little bit now, hasn't it?
Right.
Yes. So what did those early Super Bowls look like? I mean, compared to what we see today?
Oh, I mean, today is like spectacular, right? You have Rihanna at halftime show. I think the first Super Bowl had the Grambling marching band, which is not a bad thing. Grambling is a small black college in Louisiana, a great band. But the showmanship, the idea that you're paying, what, $7 million to get on a commercial, whereas that first Super Bowl cost like about $2 million to produce. But what's the same that's going on is the players still care about, like, deeply. Like, this is the main game of the year. It's still at a neutral site. So that first Super Bowl is in the LA Coliseum. And it still finds a way to put the best teams against each other with star players. So, you know, no pun intended, Bart Starr is playing of the Green Bay Packers. He's playing in the first Super Bowl. And now, like, this Super Bowl, the star power is, you know, quarterbacks. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there are some things that changed, and there are a lot of things that stayed the same that make it such a great game.
And you talked a little bit about the halftime shows and those commercials, of course, but how did we get from, you know, the marching band to Rihanna? I mean, what happened in between to make this I think I was told that the entertainers don't actually get paid for doing it. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of years ago they tried to force the entertainers to actually pay them, right? Because, you know, what happens when you're the halftime show, you get it, everybody's watching you, right? And
right.
It's probably the only time in your career where all eyes will be on you. And now all of a sudden people who might not have been introduced to your work, you know, will want to buy it. Now, you know, 30 years ago, of course, everybody had heard of Michael Jackson, but still, you know, that's a big boom for him. And I think it's just the NFL realized a while ago that they had the best show, right? They had the biggest event in America that everybody was going to watch. So why not capitalize it and make sure it's more than just football, but it is entertainment.
Sure. Now, this year's game will be the first between two black starting quarterbacks, Patrick Mahomes and Jalen Hurts. What can you share about the history of black quarterbacks in professional football?
It's a long history of guys just trying to make it where the game told them they weren't good enough and they had no place in it. And even like, so we're, you know, Wisconsin NPR, so we can bring up the Green Bay Packers. The Packers had one of the first black quarterbacks, Charlie Choo-Choo Brackens, in 1955. And he only throws like a handful of passes before they cut him. On their first Super Bowl winning team, they have a black quarterback, but they Willie Woods, but they wound up switching him to safety early on in his career. And the reason why I bring that up, because that's what happened to a lot of these guys, right? They're never getting the full opportunity, whether it's Choo-Choo Brackens or Willie Woods, and to show if they're capable of actually making it. And the reason that is because of the stereotypes that surround the position. It said that, you know, the quarterback has to be the smartest person on the field. It says that he has to be a leader. Will his teammates get along with him? And for the longest time, the NFL would just reject black players. And so, but over the years, I think they started to realize that there's a lot of talent in these quarterbacks, whether it's Doug Williams, who's the first black quarterback to win a Super Bowl, or later down the line, someone like a Jalen Hurts, who was a star in college. But I don't think 30 years ago, he gets the same opportunity that he did today.
We talked to the author of a book called The Forgotten First. I think that was about 2 years ago, a year ago or so, and is talking about some of the first black football players and the raw deal that they got. And it was such good reading. And by the way, we've got a link, so if anybody wants to listen to it. But there was a time where they're just, even though the players were so good, that the teams just said no. Why was that? I mean, that was kind of like, you know, cutting off their nose to spite their face, basically.
Yeah, you know, I think so. What you're talking about, so when the NFL starts in 1920, it is integrated. And so they do have a few black players. But by 1933, they go for segregation. And part of it is that you have owners that don't want to sign black players. You have white players that don't want to play with black players. What sports does in this country, especially during Jim Crow, you know, during the Civil Rights Movement, when you see black and white, it means they're equal, right? That's why we love sports in America so much. It is probably the one place in society where things are truly fair, right? We play by the same rules, we have the same equipment. And so when you see black and white together, that means, you know, we're equal. And I think so many people for so long were reluctant to realize that, to say, yes, this is true. And so the NFL kept players out. But by 1946, as you say, you can't deny that talent. And slowly but surely, they'll add black players. So look, when, you know, the Green Bay Packers will bring up the Packers, when Choo-Choo Brackens, Charlie Choo-Choo Brackens, that's his nickname, Choo-Choo Brackens, when he signs in 1955, they only have four black players, right? But increasingly, like teams that would only have four black players would go from four to 10 to half. And now we're at like 70% of the league because they realize you can't deny that talent.
So what are some of the barriers that are like right now? What do the black players, are they still facing this type of discrimination? What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, so I don't think black players in general face a whole lot of discrimination in league, getting to the league. I think there are barriers to some positions. I think quarterback, just in general, like youth sports, the way youth sports is going, if any parents are out there, they probably know what I'm talking about. It's a $1 billion industry. And so to be elite, you have to start paying a lot of money for trainers. And that's where quarterback is going. You got to have elite trainers at a young age. And I think there might be a barrier there, in terms of class and affordability, but off the field, the barriers in the coaching ranks, black coaches still struggle to get head coaching jobs. And we don't know why, right? They've proven to be great coordinators, but you know, teams are still reluctant to hire a black man to lead their team, to be the face of their franchise.
We're talking with Lewis Moore. He is a professor of history at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. He specializes in sport, African American, and gender history. What are your thoughts on the impact of Black players and coaches in football? We'd like to hear from you. Open lines 800-642-1234. Our on-air producer today is Clara Newport, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. And this is the Larry Mueller Show, and we're talking sports. This is the second Tuesday of the month. I'm Jill Nadeau in for Larry Mueller. After 11:45, we're going to talk about weightlifting. But right now, we are talking a little bit about the Super Bowl and some of the ways that race have played a role in the game. And Lewis, we had talked about, you know, this being the first time two starting Black quarterbacks are playing, but there has been a time when two quarterbacks actually played each other, Doug Williams and Vince Evans. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, so that's the first game that Black quarterbacks started against each other in the regular season. So that's September 30th, 1979. Okay. And I'm actually trying to write a book about it. And just right now in the editing process and trying to tell that story, really a deep look at quarterbacking and just those two guys' lives. But it took a long time to get there. Two separate quarterbacks. Doug Williams went to Grambling, so a Black college in the South. Classic quarterback, drop back quarterback, just like the pros liked. It was first round draft pick in 1978, whereas Vince Evans is a running quarterback and a guy who many thought could be a running back and maybe should be a running back and just built himself into a quarterback. It's a tremendous story of how they got there because, you know, both of them have to face adversity. You know, Vince, who played at USC, hate mail, they would, you know, after his junior season, there were signs, you know, on bumper stickers on cars that says save USC football, shoot Vince Evans. And despite all of that, he makes it to the league with the Chicago Bears. Sorry, Green Bay Packers. And his best game ever is actually against the Green Bay Packers. I feel sorry for Wisconsin fans, but still, it's a tremendous story of just how two guys persevere and push through all the stereotypes and all the hate and all the racist vitriol to make it to play in that game.
The Bills, DeMar Hamlin, his injury brought a lot of attention to the accusation that America is, you know, willing to sacrifice Black bodies and minds just for entertainment. Tell us first about the injury for those who don't remember. And what do you think about that?
Yeah, so the injury was scary because I was watching the game on Monday Night Football. So it's Bills, Bengals, and all of a sudden this guy goes down. And I was like, oh, my gosh, did we just see somebody die on the field?
Yeah.
But what the author, I believe it's Tracy Canada, who's a sports anthropologist at Duke, was trying to make the point is that a lot of the positions, because of the history of the game, are the guys who are getting hurt in the trenches and where the league hasn't protected them. Are Black players, and so Hamlin is a what we call a cornerback, and traditionally all cornerbacks are Black, right? I don't think there is a white cornerback in the NFL. There are a few white safeties, and what happens is over the years, we're talking about, you know, decades and decades and decades, it's called stacking. And stacking in sports is where you put a player into a position based on like racial stereotypes. And so for the longest time, the cornerback position was thought to be the easiest position. You just need to be athletic and react. And so professional football started to put Black athletes there. And so even in 1968, so great example of this. So in 1968, the Oakland Raiders of that time, now they're Las Vegas, they drafted a Black quarterback in the first round, Eldridge Dickey of Tennessee State University, and they changed him to a wide receiver. But the owner at that time, Al Davis, is asked about it because it's a big deal. You draft a Black quarterback. And he says, how come nobody asked me about the fact that I have the only white cornerback, right? The white corner, the only one in the whole AFL. So there's one. And that just shows you what's been happening at that time, because it's not like white guys aren't great athletes, right? They're great athletes. But a lot of times young white kids from high school, even to today, from high school to college, they get put out of that position, right? Because the thinking from coaches, so it's not just what with Black athletes, white athletes too, the thinking from coaches that you can't make it. So if you look like a position like running back, right? There's one predominant white running back, Chris McCaffrey, right? Who's really good. most white running backs, by the time they get to college, are asked to play linebacker or asked to play something like strong safety, not necessarily free safety. And so that's, you know, stereotypes go both ways in football. And so that's how you get a position where it looks like, you know, young black bodies are just being kind of thrown out there. And so that's what I think, that's what, you know, Professor was Canada was talking about there.
Okay. Thank you for that insight. You know, Jackie Robinson was, of course, a household name for being the first African American in Major League Baseball. Who was it that broke the color barrier in football?
So, you know, there's two answers to that. And so one, it's Fritz Pollard, right? One of the first black players when the NFL was created in 1920. So Fritz was from Chicago, and then I believe he goes to Brown and is a running back. And then, as I mentioned before, the NFL, so it starts out integrated, then by the mid-1930s, they segregate. And so then when the NFL reintegrates, it's what we talk about, the Forgotten Four. There's four black players that play in the 1946 season. So the Cleveland Browns, which is a new team, so it's not part of the NFL, but they will be. They have Marion Motley and Bill Willis. And then in the NFL, you know, still today's NFL, the Los Angeles Rams bring in Kenny Washington and Woody Strode. And the Rams moved that year, 1946, from Cleveland to Los Angeles. And as part of the deal they have to make to be able to use a public facility, which is the LA Coliseum, they can no longer discriminate. And so they're forced to sign a black player. And it's obvious that, you know, Kenny Washington's the right choice because he's a college football star like 5 years prior. And he's very popular. And for them, it makes sense, right? You get to sell tickets, you get to like get past this discrimination clause, and you get a really good player who unfortunately was kind of past his prime because of knee injuries. But yeah, those are the, I know it's long winded, but those are the four guys that we consider those who broke that barrier.
Yeah, again, I'll put a plug in for that, the story we did on that book. If anybody wants to know more about that in depth, excellent book, The First Four, I believe it's called, The Forgotten First, that's what it was called. So David emailed us, and this is kind of related, and David said that Branch Rickey and Jackie Robinson, Rickey wanted to win the pennant and, of course, put people in seats in his ballpark. Was there a similar story in the return of black players to pro football, and how did that come about?
You know, I think the closest would be the Cleveland Browns and Paul Brown. So, again, the Cleveland Browns is part of the All-American Football League. And it's a new conference. But what Paul Brown, who's one of the greatest coaches of all time, would say, he would say, look, I don't care what color the players is. If he's the top 11, I'm going to play him if he helps me win. And those early Browns teams in the 40s and the 50s that integrated were some of the most dominant teams in professional football at that time. And I think that's the closest. Somebody who's like searching for the best players, whereas the Rams situation is not like that because they were forced to integrate. Rickey, in his situation, was a little bit ahead of being forced to integrate. Now the Rickey story too is New York at that time, if you're a baseball fan, actually passed a law that if you had more than six employees, you could no longer racially discriminate. So what that meant was eventually, so that same year, so 1945, they passed that law. So eventually, if you're the Giants, you're the Yankees, or the Dodgers, you would have to integrate. Rickey got ahead of that. He signs Jackie Robinson in 1945. Robinson, the next year, 1946, plays minor league ball in Montreal. And then in 1947, they bring him up for the Dodgers.
We're talking with Lewis Moore. He's a professor of history at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. He specializes in sport, African-American, and gender history. We'd like to hear from you. What questions do you have about the history of the Super Bowl? Some of you probably were at a couple of those Super Bowl games in Green Bay. Join us by calling 800-642-1234. Or you can join us by sending an email to ideas@wpr.org. Now, we kind of talked about it a little bit about coaches, but that's another that's an area where definitely haven't made much progress. What's the history of black coaches in the NFL?
Yeah, so the first one's Art Shell, 1989. I would say Oakland Raiders, Los Angeles Raiders. I think today's kind of hard to follow who gets fired and hired, but I believe there's three right now. D'Amico Ryan's Mike McDaniel. I don't know how he counts himself. I don't think he counts himself as black, but there's a whole story to that. And then Mike Tomlin. But it's, I think part of the reason why you don't see so many is it's because coaching is very based on word of mouth. It's who you know. And for the longest time, a lot of these black players would play, but the teams wouldn't keep them around. So you're not really building up an opportunity to be a professional coach. You're not really making those connections. Coaching is really about those good old boy connections, about, you know, who you know and how you get into the door. So even today, even some of the great coaches today, like Kyle Shanahan of the 49ers or McVay of the Rams, their dads were coaches, their grandparents were coaches. And so even though it's not to say they're not great, they're not brilliant, but that's how they get in. And if you look at LaFleur for the Green Bay Packers, his relationship with them helps them out, right? Being able to be around a Kyle Shanahan and a Mike Shanahan, right? It's who you know. And then all of a sudden teams say, aha, it's that guy. And so for the longest, black coaches don't have that, right? They don't have that. There's not a lot of deep coaching trees. Not maybe Tony Dungy has a decent coaching tree, but there's not that kind of day-to-day connection where owners feel comfortable and say, okay, this is the guy. And so that's why we only have three. But the NFL is doing things about it. They have an internship program now towards minority coaches, not just, you know, Jack Black Nails, but you'll see more women get opportunity. In fact, on the sidelines for the Super Bowl, there will be another year that we have a woman assistant coach helping out. And so the NFL realized that they've made a mistake over a long time and are trying new things to change that.
Yeah, that's definitely forward thinking. So we got a ways to go. But yeah, it's definitely looking a little different on the sidelines. We have a caller. Irene in Phillips has something to say. Hi, Irene.
Hi there. I just have a comment about Super Bowl II many, many, many years ago. We played the Oakland Raiders and in Miami, Florida. The tickets were only $12.50 a piece, as I recall. And my late husband and I met Vince Lombardi the night before the game, eating out with his group at a restaurant we were at. I mean, players could go out in public then, and coaches, and the stadium was not even filled, and I don't even remember halftime. So things were very, very different then. I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Irene. Appreciate you sharing that. Comments there, Lewis?
Yeah, no, that's awesome, right? I think my favorite part is just the price of things. and like, you could get a hot dog and a soda for like $1.50 back then. And now it's really, I don't know what it's like in Green Bay just because of the way the ownership works, but it's really unaffordable for a lot of people to get an opportunity to go to just a game in general, right? But to the Super Bowl, it's, you know, everybody's kind of priced out, and that's unfortunate. But the good thing is that we all have flat screen TVs that are pretty cheap, and so it's like you're there. But yeah, just a wonderful memory. So it's Raiders, it's Packers, two great powerhouse franchises, right, going at it. And it's in Miami, so, you know, if you're from Green Bay, you can't beat that in January, right, heading to Miami.
Amen. Although it's warmer today, so I guess I can't complain
too much. Yeah, we're at 40
yeah,
today.
So, exactly.
Yeah, it feels nice.
It feels great. So let's talk about that whole thing. The Super Bowl, that first year, first few years, it really wasn't super popular. What changed that?
You know, I think that people were reluctant to give pro football for the longest time a chance. You know, Americans love baseball and they really loved college football. And I think it took them a while to get used to the fact that these guys are going to be making $100,000 just to play football, right? We kind of love the idea of people playing for free for the love of the game when it came to football. So for a lot of Americans, it was just like, man, they get paid too much to play this, you know, child's game. And then the violence, I think it smacked of, you know, kind of wrestling. But over the years, you know, society changes, you know, football becomes the sport. I think adding a Monday night football game, making sure that they're the only ticket in town, helps out a lot. Baseball's problems, you know, people change. Baseball takes 3 hours. And I think Americans like this idea of football being constant action. I think it helps them out. And now it's the number one sport, right? I think if you'd ask me, it's probably professional football, college football, and then perhaps the NBA and baseball are battling it out. But that certainly helps, right? When people, you know, they grew the game, they grew it correctly, and now it's the hottest ticket in town.
So you've seen the waves of popularity for different sports. Do you see football still staying at the top of the list for a while yet, or do you see another sport that's kind of encroaching on that popularity?
Pickleball. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. I won't say it. People will probably hate me if I say something about pickleball. But I just think there's, you know, honestly, I think people like football because of the violence. And I think there's just a need for people to see that outlet. And that's how football has always been sold in the past, as this outlet for violence and manliness. And I thought for a time, maybe a few years ago, when people would talk about concussions, that maybe football would go away. But people just like, I mean, we're just so used to that routine of September to February. But on serious note, pickleball is a very fast growing sport. Now, you know, I'm not anti pickleball, listeners. It just takes up a lot of space for four people to play the game. And I'm actually on a pickleball note. I'm actually to see where it goes, because it started out, and not to be offend anybody, but it started out when I saw it, you know, at the local Y, it was older folks playing during the day. And now I think a lot of young people are getting involved. And my hope is that the older people don't get pushed out, because it seems like a great game to continue to be active. It's competitive, but you're not necessarily moving so much. And I think younger kids will get in there, and all the money being thrown in because they're starting a pickleball association might push people out of it. And that's what I worry about. Like, so it's going to grow, but I don't want people like the people who really need it for that activity to be pushed out of the game.
Well, and it is a simple game, really. You don't have to move around a lot, so it makes less sense. We did cover pickleball a couple years ago, okay. So we were at the top of the trend there.
I saw it developing. I was like, what is this game that's getting people kicked off of basketball courts? And then all of a sudden now, like major pro athletes have invested in, like LeBron, Tom Brady. And so I don't know if they're investing it because they see it's growing, or they're just kind of laundering their money, you know, like this is like the scene, like an uncut scene from the Ozarks. So I'm still trying to figure out where the game is going.
It'll be interesting to watch that. And I know we totally got off the Super Bowl, but
it was pickleball.
We had to talk about it. So yeah. Let's go back to the phone. We have Cody and Cameron with a question. Hi, Cody.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. What's on your mind?
Well, I heard him mention that the reason that, you know, the Super Bowl and football is such a high watch sport, and it's one of the more popular ones. But, I mean, along with the NHL and hockey, I mean, that's a pretty, you know, a lot of violence. There's mid-game fights. There's a lot of hard hitting, and that takes a toll on, you know, on the players and stuff. So I was just curious how that matched up against the Super Bowl and football.
Okay, thanks, Cody. So how do they relate to each other there?
I think they relate in the sense that we watch them because they're violent and athletic at the same time. And again, there's a lot of violence in hockey. And hockey over the years has done a better job of, especially when we talk concussions, of dealing with their sport. And so you don't have the enforcer as much anymore. They're trying to be more, you know, I don't know, more skilled. I'm not saying the enforcer, look, it takes a lot of skill to be able to fight on skates. But yeah. It is very dangerous. And a lot of those guys, the older players, would fight and fight a lot and knock people over. They deal with a lot of health issues afterwards. And so football and hockey are in that same plane there, where they have a lot of older players dealing with health issues. And I think realizing on the fly that they have to change the game. I think the struggle with hockey, if you're not a fan, is really the you know, TV has gotten better, but still that puck is hard to see for a lot of folks. And the game kind of moves really fast. Whereas football is this quintessential American game where we like things stopped in America. We like things, you know, time and order, and football is the game that does that, right? There's, you know, there's four downs. We know you have to get 10 yards. The lines are very clearly marked. And now they even got like a chip in the ball to kind of tell you where the ball is. And when you watch the game, there's a yellow line going across the field. And so there's order. We know what's going on. There's a lot of stoppage, maybe too much stoppage, but I think it allows people just to kind of relax, get excited. And at the same time, knowing what's going on. And that's where I think hockey struggles. Unless you know, you're kind of deep inside, you know the rules, it's fun to watch. But the pace of the game, it's very fast. It's very like basketball, But, you know, the ball of basketball is a little bit bigger. I understand it. I see those threes coming. I see those dunks coming. So I'm not anti-hockey. I just think, yeah.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I never thought about it that way. But, yeah, it is hard to keep that puck in your eyes. And the camera people do a great job, but you still can't find it. So what do you think, what are the effects of, like, these fantasy football and even video games that have to do with football? How do they impact people's love of the game?
Yeah, it makes it watchable. And so fantasy football and betting, right? I don't know where Wisconsin is on sports betting, but here in Michigan, we have sports betting. So we get commercials all the time. Or if you watch a sports show nowadays, instead of highlights, you get them talking about some random game about betting. And I think it draws fans' interest in, and the leagues know it. And so they really geared towards that person who wants to bet or play fantasy football, right? And so, you know, maybe my favorite team, if you're a Packers fan, you know, maybe they're out of contention. Sorry, Packers. but, you know, towards the end of the year, but you can still watch people. You can still root for other teams. And I think that draws a lot of interest, you know, versus other sports that don't necessarily. I mean, NBA, MLB have fantasy sports, but it's not as fun to me, because now you're dealing with 82 games or 162 games. In the NFL, it's 18 weeks. It's 17 games. It's pretty straightforward. And then, like I said, you had that betting element where you could bet on your phone. Now, I worry about some of my college students losing their book money on betting on random stuff. But I think that's where sports is going.
And Clara, our producer, said that we have sports betting. It's legal at some casinos on reservations. So there is some, but not generally. So, yeah, even though people probably go over the border. But
they go over the border, right? You can go anywhere now. I think Illinois probably has sports betting, too. And so it's. You know, you just got to cash your ticket there. But I think it's coming, right? Because why would Wisconsin want to be boxed out of that and lose tax dollars?
Right. Well, so my guess is, kind of what it boils down to. It boils down to money so much,
right?
Doesn't it?
So much money.
Let's go to Dan in Madison. Hi, Dan. What can we help you
with?
Hey,
how's it going?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just calling to see if you guys had any thoughts about professional soccer. I saw a lot of kind of buzz this year with the World Cup games, with the U.S. team in that. And if there's any core lessons between that and, you know, kind of the early days of football.
Yeah, great point there, Dan. I kind of felt the same way. Lewis, did you?
Yeah, it's, you know, football, soccer's been around forever too, right? And football comes from it. But, you know, these other leagues have such a huge head start on soccer. But I think over the last few years, we've seen Major League Soccer making an impact and really kind of cutting into that. And I think they've cut into, you know, NASCARs, right? I think for a while people thought NASCAR was maybe like the fifth sport, but I think MLS, soccer, and plus now that we could watch games in England or in France, you know, you have to get up pretty early in the morning to do that. It's helped out. But we'll see, right? I think for the MLS to really be big, is some of our stars will have to stay home, right? The problem with Major League Soccer is it's not the main league, right? And the NBA is the main league. Baseball is not really played in other places, but I mean, outside of the hemisphere, but it's the main league. And, you know, football, it's main sport here. Whereas MLS, I think there's a sense that it is probably like maybe at best a top 10 league around the world. So you're not getting top 10 players, but I think Messi is going to play, if I have that correct, in Miami. So that's going to draw fans in. The World Cup is coming to the U.S., and so that's going to change some things. I don't know if Wisconsin is getting the game, but I'm pretty sure Chicago or Detroit is going to get a game there, and that is going to have a major impact. So I think there's people who are gearing up for that. And I like the idea of, like, soccer expanding the way it's set up, where you can have like a local team and you can just walk to the field versus like this big stadium that you have to go to for basketball and our football. And plus Ted Lasso is such a great show that I think it's going to have an impact on people, like casual fans like me, right? Who want to be part of the story. I could see a show having an impact.
For those who are not aware, Ted Lasso is a television show on Apple TV, and it's brilliant. Lots of awards, and yeah, it's just a wonderful show. So thank you so much for that question. Really appreciate that. So we're talking about soccer. Now, I was noticing that, I mean, the women's soccer team in the United States is phenomenal. The men's team, not so much. But it seemed to me that the men's team that wasn't so great was getting way more press than the women's team was getting when they were they're winning. Is it just me being prejudiced, or is that something you've seen too?
No, that's the history of American sports, right? Women have struggled to get their proper due, even though the women's team, the women's national team, has won a number of World Cups. We still don't put them on the same plane, and that's just a part of the history of sport. You know, if we go back 130 years, 140 years, it's really developed to be, you know, make boys into men. And so when women start to play sport, there's always been a major pushback of their participation or what it's going to look like. But, you know, the other reason why our team does dominate, and this is to perhaps brighten things up, is that, you know, in America, we have Title IX passed in 1972, which now it doesn't say anything about sports. It's about education and you can't discriminate based on sex, but it's had a tremendous impact on sports. And so our women's teams are traditionally better than other nations' teams because of the way we've have funded them from the ground up. Now our men's team struggle because there are other sports that young boys have been traditionally into, baseball, basketball. We put them into soccer. And then what we do here, which is awful, is, as I talked about at the beginning, is our youth sports complex is out of control. And so for you to be really good at soccer, you have to pay thousands of dollars starting at a young age, like a very young age. And a lot of parents like, it's not worth it to put my 8-year-old kid on a travel soccer team and pay $1,000. And other parents see it is worth it. But once you do that, you're not getting the best athletes because, you know, you're just really creating a market of the people who can afford the game. And it's unfortunate.
Yeah, I see that a lot with a lot of different sports for sure.
Yeah.
So we're running out of time here, and I can't let you go without asking you who you think's going to win the Super Bowl.
I like the Kansas City Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes. So why? Because it's Patrick Mahomes, and I just also think that the Eagles might not be ready for this moment. This is the third Super Bowl in 5 years for the Chiefs. I think they're pretty relaxed. We started this show talking about the spectacle of the game, and I think that gets to a lot of people. I also think that, you know, the last two opponents for the Eagles didn't prepare them for this game. So they have a great defense, they have a great offense, but I think, you know, just Mahomes and experience will be enough.
As long as it's a good game. We've had some really good ones in the past few years. Before right. that, there were some kind of stinkers. That was boring,
but
it should be a good game though, right?
It better be a good game. I gotta get up early in the morning. Like, I'm full on pushing for a Super Bowl holiday on Monday. But yeah, I hope it's a good game.
Excellent.
I'm staying up regardless. Yeah.
Okay. So. It's wonderful. Thank you so much, Professor Moore, for being with us. It's been really interesting and really fun. And I hope you can come back and talk to us again about some other sports. So.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for having me.
All right, great. We've been talking with Lewis Moore. He's a professor of history at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. He specializes in sport, African-American, and gender history. Now, stay with us on the Ideas Network because we're going to be right back to take a closer look at weightlifting.